like going through the world as if nothing had happened when everything had happened, when everything had changed. My entire past was being recoded in my mind. My entire future was a mystery, you know, where I thought I had things that you know, were threads of permanence that would run through my life. And there was nothing to take comfort in. There was nothing, there was no rituals, but there was also not the things that when someone loses a parent after, you know, a loving relationship and hopefully a long life together, there are things that you can take comfort in. There's that concept of continuing bonds.
Hello and welcome. My name is Liz Gleason and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from international guests who share their unique experience of grief. These stories are shared with the wish that you, the listener, may find some comfort, hope, and solidarity, and maybe also the realization that you're not alone in your grief. Each time you listen, please do support the podcast by donating on the website shapesofgrief.com or by becoming a patron on patreon.com. It's a privilege to hold these conversations, and I extend my deepest gratitude to all my guests for showing up in this particular way. It truly is a gift.
This is going to be a very exciting episode of Shapes of Grief. We're taking a new subject today, but also under the umbrella of grief. And it's a subject that I've thought about quite a lot, actually. And then Phoenix, when you wrote to me, I was like, great, okay, it found me, rather than me having to go out and look for someone. So Phoenix, you're very, very welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Liz. And your incredibly warm reply when I reached out to you was very, very heartening. So thank you for that.
Oh, great. So first of all, a few listeners can judge by the accent where you're from. But I know that in Australia, you have a very specific way of introducing your land. Would you talk us through that?
That's right. So we have a custom here called Acknowledgement of Country, which is part of a nationwide process of healing and reconciliation. So I'll just take a few moments to do that now. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country, including any First Nations people listening today, and their enduring sovereignty of land, sea, sky, traditional knowledge, kinship systems, and community wisdom. I bear witness to their diversity and resilience and honour the elders past, present, and emerging. I specifically acknowledge the Turrbal and Yagara people whose stolen land I'm speaking from today. I acknowledge that colonization is not just our history, it's an ongoing present-day lived experience. This is, was, and always will be Aboriginal land.
And actually, that's a whole other podcast episode, isn't it?
Yes,
I think the ravages of colonization.
Absolutely, the grief of colonization is immense. I think that would be very worthwhile.
I think for a lot of us, you know, certainly middle-aged, middle-class, white-skinned people, it's something that just doesn't enter our consciousness. But I love the way Australians do this. And I heard Diana Sands introduce Australia in a similar manner when I did a webinar for PACFA last year. And it's a really beautiful, important custom. It puts context in everything we do and everything we're talking about. So Phoenix, my mind is whirring because you and I are going to talk about the grief of growing up queer, the grief of living as queer, and the losses. It's not that being queer is sad or causes grief, but the marginalization, the stigma, the loneliness that can come with that can cause immense grief. So let's start with your name, Phoenix. You tell me, you know, this is it. It's just Phoenix. I don't use my given names anymore. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, so my given names I don't use because they're culturally appropriated, and Phoenix is legally my surname. And it's a surname that I chose for myself. Over the course of the episode, I will be, you know, talking a little bit about the people that used to be my family. And I reached a point where having their name wasn't right for me anymore. So I chose this name because it's kind of been my journey throughout life, is I've kept on getting burned away in the fire, getting destroyed and then rising up again. So it means a lot to me. So thank you for asking about that.
You know, there is going to be a lot of people listening today. I know in Ireland, we're such a cynical country, who are going to be listening going, what are they talking about? You know, what is this? And I really encourage people, if you are triggered by what we are talking about, you really, really are invited to sit down and ask yourself, why am I so triggered about this? And I remember sort of becoming aware of this, Phoenix. A few years ago, I had a child who was gender nonconforming, and I was having dinner with two really, really good friends of mine, and they couldn't deal with it. They couldn't deal with my child's presence. They couldn't deal with the ambiguity of gender. They couldn't deal with the exploration. And it was so deeply upsetting, because here's my kid. I'm a mom bear. I will rip anyone to shreds who would harm my child in any way, physically or emotionally. And I remember seeing them being so triggered, thinking, what is going on here? Here's two people I love and they love me, and they're so angry about how my seven-year-old is dressing, you know? What is this about? And I was really confused. But a few months later, it was coming up to Halloween, and there was a video out, and it was about cultural appropriation and how we dress for Halloween. And I found myself getting really triggered, going, oh, for God's sake, and it's so this and it's so that. And my response reminded me of that day with my friends. And I thought, what is going on here? Why am I so triggered? What am I not understanding? And I listened to that three times, that video. And by the end of it, when I literally sat down intentionally to understand, what is cultural appropriation? Why is it pressing my buttons? What do I need to learn about myself here? I got it. So a long way of saying to anyone listening, please stick in with us and listen if you can without judgment, but from a perspective of, maybe I'll learn something today. Maybe I'll actually hear something and learn something that'll make a difference.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think you raise a really important point, which is that one of the most powerful and loving qualities I think we can bring to the world is curiosity. And when we encounter something that we don't understand, rather than going, well, that must be wrong, instead going, what am I not understanding here? And so I'm very happy to be here, hopefully sharing a bit of understanding of something that not everyone might have encountered. And also that mother bear in you at that dinner, I just want to give that mother bear a big hug right now, because that is it just warms my heart to know that that there are parents who are being so supportive and protective of their whether it's gender non-conforming children or queer children or whatever.
And really, that's a little bit about, you know, why we're here today. There are some parents who are iguanas. They're not mother bears at all. There's a cold, you know, lack of support there. So let's jump right in, Phoenix. Where does your story begin?
Well, it's interesting you said earlier growing up queer, which isn't quite what my experience was, because I actually didn't realize I was queer until I was in my late 20s. So I didn't, I'm trying to find how to sort of articulate this. Actually, before I get into the story, it might help if I just sort of position myself in terms of a few of the different identities and intersections that I have. And if it's okay with you, I have a little paragraph from a piece of writing I've been working on recently that I think sums it up much better than I would if I tried to waffle. So
I mean, I embrace waffle, but go for it. If you've got that, cool. Let's have a listen.
Cool. I'm white Anglo living on unceded Turrbal and Yagara lands in a place called Minjin, which is colonially known as Brisbane, Australia. I am sighted, hearing, mostly able-bodied, monolingual, and in my mid-40s. I'm queer in a complex myriad of ways. My sexuality is fluid, currently asexual. I'm polyamorous by orientation and unpartnered by choice. The best words I can find for my gender are cisgender unwoman, which means I identify with the gender I was assigned at birth, but I reject its socially constructed strictures. I have what the DSM calls ADHD, though I prefer to depathologize this by calling it zoomy brain. I'm autistic, but functionally allistic due to deeply internalized masking. I'm a parent, and I became so via my own body undergoing pregnancy and birth. My three children are now adults, two cisgender daughters, and a trans non-binary adult kid. Aside from my children, my kinship system is not biological for reasons that will unfold as we talk, but consists of beloved friends and queer familial kin. I'm a survivor of many and varied traumas. I am strong as fuck. I am fragile as cobweb. I'm full of love. I am full of rage. I am kind.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. And I'd love, you know, I'm not going to ask you to read it again, but if you're willing, I'd love you to share that with me so that anyone listening can read again. And I'm sure there will be so much identification and others who won't identify, they won't understand half of that. But like we said at the beginning, you know, stay, listen, learn. So you came to your queerness in your 20s. How did that go down at home?
Well, I might set the scene a little bit first. So it was a bit over a decade ago that happened. Well, a bit more than a bit over a decade ago now. I'm getting older. The household I grew up in was incredibly loving in a lot of ways and incredibly volatile in a lot of ways. So there was kind of a cycle of emotional abuse that existed already, but it would swing between sort of extremes. So that's sort of the background of the family that I was in. And I got married quite young, and in retrospect, that was in large part my ticket out of that environment. And I had kids quite young before I'd really figured out who I was. And then in my late 20s, I started to realize that I prefer to say relationship orientation rather than sexual orientation, because it's about so much more than, you know, the genders that I'd like to go to bed with. I realized my relationship orientations didn't fit within the structure of that marriage and that relationship. And my then husband and I had a series of very, what I thought were very deep, open, trusting conversations about what that meant. But I didn't realize that it was taking a toll on him that was more than I knew. Perhaps more than I wanted to know. Yeah. And so what happened was, in what I think was an act of desperation on his part, on one day he outed me to 9 family members. So my parents, his parents, brothers, sisters, aunts. So it went very suddenly, sort of this whole world around me started to basically go on the attack. I don't want to give too much specifics about what happened, first of all, to avoid identifying details, but also out of respect for the privacy of everyone involved. But the biggest part of it that I think is so important for this discussion today is that the more accurate words, I was going to say my parents, but the more accurate words are the people who used to be my parents, because they're not my parents anymore. They took action that was aimed at depriving my children of their mother. And they did, without going into details, what they did was extreme. It was illegal. And they continued to do it even after being told by qualified professionals that they were severely psychologically damaging my children. Mm. And this went on for an extended period, like the best part of a year, before I could make my children safe. And we are all still carrying the damage from that time. Mm. So the grief that I reached out to you to talk about is that once that happened, I could not have them in my life anymore. There was no way that there could be any kind of reconciliation after that. And if they'd been hurting me, you know, it might be different. But like you said before about the mama bear, you know, they damaged my children. And as a result, I had to make just a devastatingly heartbreaking decision to remove my family from my life.
Yeah. And it's usually the last thing we want to do. We so desperately want something else for ourselves, for our children.
Yeah.
And I think when it's blood, when it's family members, we let it go so much further than we ever would if it was someone non-related. Mm-hmm. Put up with so much harm. I'm so sorry that happened to you, Phoenix.
Thank you.
This is like this type of estrangement is, I suppose, it would fall under what we call ambiguous loss. Mm. Nobody has died, but so much has happened. And I think what I'm really hearing from you is the trauma of that time. I mean, to separate children from their mother is traumatic. There's no other word for it. And the impact on the nervous system, I can understand why you'd still be dealing with the resonance of that.
Yeah, we definitely still are. You can probably hear in my voice how it comes alive already, just talking about it a little bit. And one of my children in particular is more affected by it. Sorry, I'm just wrestling with myself on how much to say about that, because I want to respect their privacy as well. But there was a lot of damage done. Yeah.
And it's really good to acknowledge this, because I know I've tried to do several interviews around the grief of divorce. Mm. And I've not published them because I feel someone might be harmed by them. You know, or relationships might be harmed by those episodes. So I understand your caution, and particularly, when there's children or other adults involved, to respect other people's privacy. Yet the importance of highlighting this type of loss can't be underestimated, because, you know, we talk about the amount of people who die in a year and therefore the amount of people who are bereaved in a year. But what we're not acknowledging is the people who are walking around with a heavy grief on their shoulders that nobody sees, nobody knows, nobody acknowledges. And it can be absolutely devastating, because no one is rocking up going, hey, sorry, you've an estranged relationship with your parents. Here's lasagna. How are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. So, yes, there was no grief buffet for this one. Yeah.
Yeah. Traumatic.
Incredibly traumatic. And I think in some ways, again, I'm trying to be careful what I say, because I recognize that I can't know what it's like to lose a beloved parent who's passed away. But I know that it was particularly traumatic in the sense that I hadn't just lost these key attachment figures in my life, but they had also been completely reclassified in my nervous system as a threat. And so there was like this double impact of that. There was the grief of the loss, and for the parents that I wanted them to be, and they proved once and for all that they could never be. And there was this incredible traumatic impact. And then there was this other part, which was this incredible relief that after this lifetime of trying to have a healthy relationship with people who really weren't capable of having a healthy parent-child relationship, that I didn't have to do that anymore, and that there was a sense of safety that I'd never had before. So this is all very mixed up and confused. Like, there's this immense loss, there's this immense trauma, and yet there's this newfound safety alongside it. Which I think it kind of works that way sometimes, that you only actually really feel the impact of the trauma when you are safe. Like, your nervous system protects you from that impact while you're in the crisis. But when the crisis has passed, when the threat is no longer there, it hits you maybe more.
I see that all the time with people who've come through cancer, and it's about 6 or 12 months after they get the all clear is when they land into my clinic and are just saying, what the hell is wrong with me? I've got all I wanted, which was the all clear, but I feel like I've been hit by a bus emotionally. And, you know, they're struggling maybe with anxiety or depression, or just trying to process it. And you're raising a really important subject here, which is the brain and the nervous system and how we grieve. And I've just been writing a bit about this over the last few days. And what you're describing, Phoenix, is all the different, the way our brains try to make sense of something. These people were safe, they were my caregivers, they're important to me. And we're wired, even if parents are abusive or unavailable or unemotional, we're still wired to attach to them. Yeah. And, you know, there's all these parts of us that are fighting our nature, but also trying to make sense of, but it doesn't work. There's a dissonance, trying to update our programming to, hang on, they're a threat now. Updating the programming again to, well, I'm a parent, I'm a mother, I have to protect my offspring. So it can be a very, very confusing time.
And if I think in particular about my mother, and in some ways I feel like it would be helpful to almost focus this discussion today around that, because just to contain it, but also because the grief for her was more intense, and I have various theories about that, why that might be, but it's taken me a long time, or it did take me a long time to get to the point of being able to say that this person who over the entire course of my life up until I broke contact had done so much damage is also the person from whom I get most of my best qualities. And to be able to hold those truths side by side, you know, there's that that sort of sorry, I've lost my words for a second.
Yeah, well, the paradox of you've
the good wolf and the bad wolf.
And you've also given me the greatest gifts.
Yes, exactly. And to be able to just hold the truth of all of that, rather than, I think for a long time I had to keep all of those sort of good qualities or those moments of you know, genuine love and care almost out of my consciousness, just to be able to psychologically survive what I was going through.
Why do you think mothers matter so much, Phoenix?
I don't know that I could answer generally, but in terms of why that grief was more intense, one of the things that I think is true for me is that There's a really strong line of intergenerational trauma running through the maternal line in my family. And my mother, the person who used to be my mother, went through incredible trauma in her youth as well. And so I think that there was an intensity to the grief in the sense that she just didn't know a better way. And whereas when I think about my dad, he should have known better. And maybe that's an accurate assessment, or maybe it's not, but I think it's that sense for me that my mother was so damaged herself, and had a lot of shame, particularly around sex and sexuality, and so this would have been particularly that arose from her trauma. So this would have been particularly triggering for her. So on the one hand, I can see this, I'm a damaged woman who can see this other damaged woman, acting out of that damage, her choices arising from that damage. And so I think there's a huge grief that, a huge grief at what had happened to her that then, led to what happened to me and what happened to my children.
It's so sad that, when we're talking about sexuality and...
Hi, everyone. Excuse this brief interruption. It's Liz here, and I wanted to tell you about my grief training program. If you are interested in becoming grief literate or grief trained, I've designed a comprehensive online program which you can do at your own pace in your own time. It's been designed primarily for healthcare providers, but we all have a right to grief training and education. So if you're interested, then it's for you too. Sign up today at shapesofgrief.com. Now, back to the podcast.
The explosions that can happen in families as a result of someone's orientation. And as you so rightly put it at the beginning, my relationship orientation, the kind of people that I'm attracted to, we're talking about, I don't know why it's reduced to genitalia so often. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, one person feeling safe with another person, opening their heart, trusting them enough to put their skin against theirs. We're talking about something so tender, so beautiful, usually so good, and yet families freak out and reduce it to genitalia.
Yeah.
Like it makes a difference. If you were to break it down, like it makes any difference.
Yeah.
And, I was in Copenhagen a couple of weeks ago at a grief conference, talking to someone who just didn't get it. She said, I don't know why LGBT people have to have their own death cafe. If you're grieving, you're grieving. Why does your sexuality make a difference? This is exactly it. It's the losses that come, the marginalization, the stigma, the topics and themes that can rise up as a result of queerness, that other people just don't have to face. Yeah. Because heterosexuality is assumed, I think, pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. And going back to that idea of ambiguous and even disenfranchised loss too, there's rituals for other kinds of loss. There's social acknowledgements of other kinds of loss. But this is a kind of loss that I'm very much not alone in. And I specialize in working with, I use the term GBKS diversity, rather than like the LGBTQIA plus sort of the letters are sort of getting who's in, who's out. So GBKS stands for gender, body, kinship and sexuality diversity. So it's sort of a more I guess, a broader, more welcoming kind of an acronym.
Mouthful. Is that an Australian thing?
No, it's there's sort of a movement worldwide to shift that, perhaps. But, you know, some people are using those terms. Some people are using LGBTQIA+. And, so that's just an aside. But working with GBKS diversity, I come across this kind of loss or very similar kinds of loss a lot. And so people who have lost their families as a result of their family's reactions. And most often it's the person themselves who has made that choice to not always, but at least in my clinical work, that they have needed to separate themselves from the family to be safe from those reactions. And then there's a whole lot of sort of related or similar versions, which, that family might still be in their life, but in a very limited capacity. Or their family is in their life, but they can't or choose not to, for valid reasons, tell their family about their partner, or even about children that they have with their partner. There are some of the most heartbreaking ones are where there's sort of an intersection of cultural things, like and particularly minority cultural things with GBKS diversity. And some of the people I work with feel like once my parents know this about me, I'm going to take their happiness away forever. So it's this sense of responsibility for that. And then there are people who are, actually living in the same house with their family of origin, where that family of origin is openly hostile towards who they are. And that's an anguish I can't even begin to comprehend. To actually, have to be in that space all the time.
Whereas humans, we're often so scared of diversity. And I think, a lot of the reactions of parents, it's perhaps not a hatred for queerness, but terrified of what does this mean? How will we be seen? How will my child be seen? How will this be interpreted by the world? There's a shame from not following the flock,
Yeah.
What did it mean for you? Can you tell us a little bit, Phoenix, about your experience of grief? And I know, it sounds like it was really masked in trauma for quite some time, but what did it feel like for you? And just to butt in, when you said there, the people who were the closest to me became a threat to me.
This is
a really important piece. And I think it happens a lot with separation and divorce.
Yes.
When there's an acrimonious divorce, the person who's been your pillar by your side turns into your enemy, real or perceived. Your body will experience it the same way.
Yeah.
And this is a part of loss and change and transition that very few people know about, but it can cause a lot of damage to us on a physiological level.
100%. I agree with you so much. And that parallel with divorce, I think that's really, really true and insightful. What that loss was like was the words that most often come to mind was this sense of just being cut adrift, it was incredibly lonely. Because my marriage had broken down as well after my husband had outed me. So I'd lost my home, my family, my marriage, and my children basically in one day. And eventually my children came back to me, but it was a long way to get there. So it was this very much being cut adrift, but also not not being able to stop, not being able to take time off work, you know, I still had to go about my life. I wasn't a therapist back then, I was a neuroscientist, but I couldn't just sort of abandon my experiments, you know, mid you know, work. They had a, you know, a timeline that had to be followed, and also you know, just being able to support myself and things like that. So there was just being like going through the world as if nothing had happened, when everything had happened, when everything had changed, my entire past was being recoded in my mind, my entire future was a mystery, you know, where I thought I had things that you know, were threads of permanence that would run through my life. And one of the things that one of the things that I there was nothing to take comfort in. There was nothing, there was no rituals, but there was also not the things that when someone loses a parent after, you know, a loving relationship and hopefully a long life together, there are things that you can take comfort in. There's that concept of continuing bonds. And I think you've said something along the lines of that death ends a life, not a relationship.
But in this case, from Tuesdays with Mari, it's not mine.
Yes. But in this case, that wasn't true. There was no continuing bond to take comfort in. And I'm going to say something now that I want to apologize for in advance. Because I know that I can never comprehend the pain of someone who's lost a beloved parent because they've passed away. But I want to be courageously truthful, even when it maybe makes me look bad. I started to find myself jealous of friends whose parents died because they were able to know that their parent would still be there loving them if they could. Whereas my parents weren't capable of loving me. And then things like Mother's Day comes along, where, you know, there's media all around you talking about how wonderful mothers are. And for those of us who that hasn't been our reality, same with Father's Day, but as I said, the grief of my mother was particularly intense. And then there was this one period where, and I think it was about 10 years after all those things happened, where I found forgiveness. And I can remember it very clearly. I was on a train on my way to a therapy appointment for myself. And I just had this thought that whatever they're doing, I just hope they're happy. And it was like this weight lifted, and I could wish them well. You know, that threat sort of went away, and I could wish them well. And I still absolutely didn't want them in my life, but in my heart, I could wish them well. And then I lost it again. And I think part of that was that one of my children started some more impacts of what had happened, what they had done to my children. Emerged that were quite serious, and the forgiveness went away, and I lost that. So I think that's really interesting, that, you know, forgiveness is not necessarily an end point. It might be an experience that comes and goes. But since then, I think I've made friends with bitterness. And I think that's been really important, because to be able to turn like this, like I said before, I'm full of rage and not just about this. I think anyone who's very compassionate and sees things that happen in the world is often full of rage. But I learned to turn to that bitterness inside of me that I'll probably always carry and say, okay, I know you're there because you've been so hurt. And it still hurts. And I'm going to hold you with love. I'm going to hold that bitterness inside me with love. And if I have to carry you for the rest of my life, I will carry you with all the love I can. And I think that that allowing that bitterness to exist inside of me without trying to therapize it away or whack it on the head and tell it that it's not allowed to be here, I think that's been important, to just say, I know you're here because you're hurting and I'm going to love you.
And I think for many of us, Phoenix, it is there in an enduring way. As long as we have to have Pride Month, as long as we have to have International Women's Day, as long as the Black Lives Movement has to exist, we need people to rage.
Yes.
You know, not to be asleep at the wheel, drive us through a white capitalistic society. That's destroying us, you know.
Yes.
It is destroying us the way we're living. And it's destroying our planet. And I wanted to come to your Zoomy brain. And you've ADHD and autism. How do you think that impacts how you are in the world and how you grieve and how you perceive things? Because, you know, a lot of people can just take things on the chin, get over, you know, this, get over it or move on, or that's just the way they are. And some of us take things deep into our cells. Do you think that's those of us who are neurodivergent have a deeper sensitivity and therefore a deeper experience of pain?
I think that certainly can be a factor. And the words that I use for it is having a very high justice sensitivity. And so for many of us who are neurodivergent, we can't just sort of go, okay, well, that sucks, but that's how it is. You know, it stays in us. We feel it. We almost can't rest with it, with knowing that any injustice is happening in the world. And then also I think, and this is more of a Zoomy brain thing, which I don't think is a strong trait for me, but I think it certainly was probably more so back when those things happened, which is rejection sensitive dysphoria. So basically that means feeling a high emotional dysregulation in the face of being rejected or disapproved of or criticized and things like that. And in that context of my, you know, the people who I should have been able to trust most in the world actually not just rejecting me but actively going to war on me. You know, even as I say that, I'm thinking, you know, you don't need rejection sensitive dysphoria to be really, really hurt by that. So I guess I don't really know if that was a factor or not. But
I mean, I suppose the factor could be that the impact on you, you know, was possibly a lot stronger than it might have been with somebody who is neurodivergent.
Yeah. I think the other thing too is that it was a very rude awakening. And again, with reference to that justice sensitivity, up until that point, you know, I kind of had a a lot of privilege. I'm white Anglo in a culture that privileges white Anglo people and culture. I am able-bodied and educated, and I have a particular kind of intelligence that responds well to the particular kind of education that I was provided. And even though in my family things were volatile, I kind of grew up with the idea in my head that the social structures that we live within, you know, things like the law and, you know, the things that are designed to make the world safe, that the world is basically a just and fair place. And then through this experience, I discovered what people are able to do, like what, even how the law can be weaponized. And it was this really big rude awakening that the world is not a just and fair place when you don't fit into the, you know, the boxes that society assumes that you should be in, or certain parts of society assume you should be in, and have become more and more aware of that as time goes on. And I'm still actively trying to educate myself further on understanding more of that.
I think we'd be remiss of us to avoid, you know, looking at how you survived this. You know, for everybody listening, what little trinkets of hope can we give the young non-binary person listening today who's had a similar trauma in their family of origin? And I remember similar around our table at home, you know, at least a couple of us out of five are queer. And I certainly remember one of my family members coming out to my parents in a heavily Catholic family of origin, and my parents responded by flying to the bishop of somewhere in London to, you know, get forgiveness and get, you know, sort of help and basically conversion therapy. And you know, my father should have known better, but he went along with it. But my mother honestly thought her child was going to burn in hell, quite literally. And so they heard of some priest in London who used to be queer and found the way and was forgiven, and they urgently needed a solution for this problem. Oh, and I remember at the time I was living with a girlfriend who my parents thought was my flatmate. Oh. And I remember sitting in, looking at this, I was probably early 20s, and thinking, I might just keep this quiet a while longer. It's worth it, but it also didn't ever feel like a tremendous loss because I just didn't have that relationship with them. Yeah. You know, I became very close to my father later in life, but certainly at that age, they didn't know any part of me. Why did this? It didn't feel important for me to come out to them because, you know, we didn't have that relationship. So I really get it when you talk about that jealousy or just that pain of grieving something that you never had.
Yeah.
Like, what would it be like to have an emotionally close relationship with a parent? You know, I have that with my children. And I like every day I kind of go, God, you're so damn lucky that we sit here and we can talk and, you know, I've got your back. And, you know, and, you know, with my kids, they know when the shit hits the fan, I've got their back no matter what, you know, and that nothing they say will shock me or harm me or make me harm them, you know.
Gosh. Again, I want to hug you. To go back to the question you asked at the start of that, that's my autistic side coming out, by the way. It's like, there was a question at the beginning and I need to not leave it.
It was spot your twin here.
So that question of how did you survive it, and the answer for me and the answer for other people obviously won't necessarily be the same, but people have asked me that question over the years. And the most accurate answer I can find is breathe in, breathe out, repeat. And I don't mean, you know, take some deep breaths and calm down. That's not what I mean. I mean, just keep breathing. Just keep letting your body keep you alive until things, you know, until you find a way to get through it. And, you know, there's that Bible quote that says, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And I've had some I had a very serious injury at one point in my life. And what I learned through that is that the spirit can be unwilling and the flesh can be strong. When we don't have the strength to keep going, our bodies will do it for us. Our bodies will keep breathing. They will keep metabolizing. Our hearts will keep beating. The blood will keep carrying oxygen around our body. And we don't have to be able to get through it. We just have to let our body carry us through it. And so when I say breathe in, breathe out, repeat, that's what I mean.
It's lovely. I actually have the symbol for breathe tattooed on my wrist.
Oh, wonderful.
And I was just talking to a friend of mine yesterday. She called over and she's having a hard time. And she was like, does that bloody tattoo work? Does it remind you to breathe? I was like, well, not really, but every now and again, maybe. But yeah, that's exactly it. It's like sometimes all we can do is get to the next breath. And that sounds very dramatic, but I think also to know that we're not alone. I think sometimes that can be such a pit that we fall into, of this horrible thing has happened to me. I'm the only person that doesn't have really good relationships with my family. Maybe it's my sensitive brain. Maybe I could have done something differently. But this is what being human is, actually. And, you know, so many people have struggles with relationships, whether it's in family, you know, or friendships or community. And I think particularly those of us who are neurodiverse with that rejection sensitivity dysphoria, you know, it's easy just to pull away from people to protect ourselves, you know, and we can find ourselves really quite isolated at times.
Yeah.
But anyone listening, it's just to constantly remember this is part of our common humanity, to experience loneliness, bitterness, rejection, regret, maybe even shame or guilt. And just keep breathing, keep moving forward, keep going, you know, because there are tremendous moments of joy in life as well. I don't really like the term post-traumatic growth. I wish we didn't have to go through trauma.
Yeah,
it's tremendous loss to grow ourselves.
Yeah, I feel the same. And you know, my name Phoenix, you know, I grow every time I go through it, but then I'm also screaming out inside, I'm big enough, I don't need to grow anymore. Please, can I just not have, you know, well, I think I'll always keep growing no matter what's happening in my life, but just that that sense of please, can I just maybe have a bit less suffering and a bit less growth? I'll take that trade.
I'm
glad you brought up friends as well, because I did have some wonderful friends who I don't think I would have gotten through it without them. But there was a very interesting social process that took me quite a few years to make sense of, where I was really reaching for people to be my family, you know. And there were a few friends in my life who were and are very, very dear to me. And when we would get close, you know, sometimes I would talk to them about, you know, could we be sisters, or could we be brother and sister? And they would agree to that. But after a period of time, I would start to realize that what that meant to them wasn't the same as what it meant to me. Like, to me, that was, I really meant that. Like, I meant, like, you know, I really, you know, I really considered them to be my family. And then it would be things like, you know, Christmas would come along and, you know, they would be with their blood family, or there would be a wedding and, you know, I would be seated, you know, at the, you know, the friends' tables, and, or they would introduce me to someone as their friend, whereas I would introduce them to people as you know, my sibling. And that was quite heartbreaking, but I learned from it that, and this is something that I would like to share with other people who might be going through similar things. I think in GBKS diverse communities, we do a wonderful job of making space for found family and chosen family. But I learned that that commitment or that understanding needs to be taken with the same kind of carefulness and discussion as getting married or entering a committed life partnership of some kind. So that was a real learning curve. So there was, but it was very clear there was this incredible yearning for this. And then much as these people in my life cared deeply for me, it wasn't it wasn't sort of a reciprocal understanding of what it meant. I have at this point in my life now got someone I refer to as my queer familial kin. And that has been possible because they also lost family in a similar way to me, not through similar events, but they've also had to distance from their family. And so they understood that yearning, I think, where many other people weren't able to. And we have also agreed that, you know what, we need to go slow with this, and we need to, you know, take the time to build this bond and recognize the vulnerability of it.
You really needed to name it, Phoenix, did you? Because I've obviously heard there's blood family and your chosen family, but for you, it sounds like you really needed to hear it articulated and named. And I'm thinking of a neurodiverse child who's a little bit like that, who's like, you know, starts to hang out with someone and it goes really well for an afternoon. And then he will say to her, usually, "Are we best friends now?" And there's that need to have it named and validated. Yeah. I've never heard, I get it, but it's like takes such courage. Like when you're describing that wedding, or I get the pain of that. And I'm moved by the courage of you naming that. I really wanted them to acknowledge me as family.
That what you just said about the neurodivergence, I hadn't put that together, but I think you're right. And part of it is, I think many of us who are neurodivergent, we give our hearts so easily and wholeheartedly.
So it sounds like an intersection there, doesn't it, as well?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Phoenix, is there anything else that feels important for you to say before we wrap up today?
Yeah, there are two things I would like to touch on. One is, and again, this is to share a bit of understanding. There's one experience I've had a couple of times where I've shared that I no longer have my family in my life and the reasons. And someone has offered to help us reconcile. And I know that that's coming from such a caring place. And I know it's coming from a frame of reference where for them, family is, you know, something good to have in your life. But it just really hurt to have people say that to me when they knew what had happened, because it just felt like you haven't possibly comprehended what this was, what, you know, the absolute awfulness of what was done and these reasons. So I wanted to share that just to say to anyone who encounters someone who has, whether it's for reasons around their relationship orientation or whether it's for completely other reasons, if someone has removed their family of origin from their life, to maybe work from the assumption that they did it with good reason. And unless they invite it, maybe tread cautiously before offering to try and reconcile. And the other thing that I'd really like to touch on, because it's sort of a new thing that's only happened recently, and I recognize that we've been talking for a really long time, so I hope there's room in the episode for this, but one thing I've been facing recently is that those people who used to be my parents are probably nearing the end of their lives now. And so I'm faced with questions like, what would I do if they reach out to me on their deathbed, or if they left me a bequest in their will? And I have sort of figured out my answers to those questions. But then the bigger thing is what that would mean. And I don't either believe or disbelieve in an afterlife. But the idea of an afterlife, if it does exist, is absolutely freaking terrifying to me, because the idea that they could be looking down on me when I have taken so much care to make sure they have no access to me, that is just horrifying. The idea that, you know, people who've had near-death experiences say that they're loved ones or their family are waiting for them on the other side, and I'm sitting here going, okay, how does this system work? You know, who decides who's there? Because do they just get to decide whether they want to be there or not? Because they'll probably want to, but that's not okay with me. Who's in charge of this, and can I speak to them? Because I, you know, so again, that's a terrifying idea that I might be met by them when I die. So that makes my death more terrifying. And in my darkest moments, I've even wished that I could die before them to make sure that that didn't happen. However, I have a very dear friend who's a fair bit older than me. So if we both live to a ripe old age, we'll probably pass on before me. And we had a talk recently, and he has agreed to be my bouncer in heaven if necessary. And he has said that if it is within his power, he will be there waiting for me, and he'll make sure that they aren't. And that's the best I can do for now.
And none of us know what's there on the other side, if anything is there, but I'm fairly sure it's not our earthly humanness that we bring with us.
That's a lovely way to put it.
Yeah, that it's a some sort of beautiful version of us that goes on. Yeah. But these are all the things that go through our heads, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, when we talk of continuing bonds, you know, what's that bond like with someone you didn't get on with someone who let you down, with someone, you know, it's not going to suddenly become good.
With someone who's actually a threat in your world.
And I wish you well, Phoenix, as you navigate that. And you know, it sounds like it's a thought that's just not helpful, whether it be true or not. It's not serving you, so I hope you find some way of resolving that.
Thank you.
Because to fear death and fear what might be there, that's tough. That's a tough one.
Yeah. It's funny, I'm not at all afraid of ceasing to exist. Like, if there is nothing after death, that's quite a peaceful thought to me.
Yeah.
But it's the idea of things going on and I guess it's that, and I hope you're right when you say it's a different way of being altogether, but it's the idea that death could bring me back in contact with that threat.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Mm. I suppose they didn't harm you before you were born, before they were born.
Mm.
You know, so wherever we all were before we were born is probably where we're going to after we die. A place of no harm.
That's a lovely thought. Thank you. I will take that and carry that with me, Liz. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your honesty and vulnerability and wisdom today. It's so important, you know, back to shapes of grief. There's not always a death. There's not always a coffin. You know, loss is all around us and it has many, many shapes and forms. And I think family estrangement or relationship estrangement is one of the most painful losses we can experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was one last thing I wanted to say on that note, which is that I think that it would be easy to think that because I've chosen to remove my family of origin from my life, that I don't see family as important, but actually it's the opposite. And when I see loving families, I can see just how precious that is. So I just wanted to say to anyone of any identities that if you have parents who love you, support you, are there for you, and embrace who you are, even if they do it imperfectly, please, please cherish them. And to all of the parents of GBKS diverse children of any age who are loving and embracing and celebrating your children, please let me offer you a blessing from my heart to yours if you would like it. And that includes you, Liz.
Thank you, Phoenix. Such a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you for reaching out and sharing your story. And I hope this reaches someone who needs it. I'm sure it will. For anybody who's listening, I hope that you understand a little bit more about queer grief and why it is important that we consider sexuality, gender identity, colour of skin when we're looking at loss.
Well said. Thank you so much, Liz.
Take care, Phoenix. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice. And if your grief is making you unwell, please do see your healthcare provider. Once again, please consider supporting the podcast by donating on shapesofgrief.com or becoming a patron on patreon.com. I rely on your support to keep going. The music is performed by Baka Beyond, especially for the Shapes of Grief podcast. Until the next time, from me, Liz Gleeson, take really good care. She has come down to condemn the wild ocean for
absolutely gorgeous.